This is the BBC.
Hello, and welcome to the Loose Ends podcast. I'm Clive Anderson, and each week in the Loose Ends studio, we bring together an unrivalled mixture of stars of stage and screen, comedy and tragedy, writers and artists, men and women of all sorts in the public eye. We stir them all together for you to enjoy. I hope you like this week's offering. Thank you very much. Welcome to Loose Ends, in a week in which an appeal court in America has confirmed that Naruto, the rare crested macaque monkey, does not own the sulfate it took of itself. Legal experts say this precedent means that if you lock an infinite number of monkeys in a room for an infinite amount of time, even if they do come up with the complete works of Shakespeare, Shakespeare will still own the copyright. Today, as summer rapidly changes into autumn and Brexit negotiations rapidly go nowhere, I'm joined by a star singer who's been performing pop and soul music since the 1960s. A writer who's been creating plays, novels, fiction and non-fiction for even longer than that, and a singer and actress who's becoming something of a regular feature here on Loose Ends. There I'm referring to Camille O'Sullivan, the marvellous Irish performer who's currently starring in the Galway Arts Festival production of Wojciech in Winter, Wojciech in Winter at London's Barbican, an extraordinary theatrical experience. The long-established writer is Michael Frayn, who's created several extraordinary experiences in the theatre of his own in his long career, has now produced in book form a pocket playhouse. And the first singing sensation I mentioned is P.P. Arnold, who on her own and in collaboration with a host of stars has been a seminal figure on both sides of the Atlantic. I'll be talking to her in just a moment. We have a music in the studio from Mali, from Amadou and Mariam, and from America, from Micah P. Hinson. And our man in Berlin, Phil Gale, is my co-host this week. Who have you got for us, Phil?
Hi, Clive. My guest used to be a hospital doctor and worked in the NHS for six demanding, emotionally draining, joyful and physically tiring years until something happened. Now he's a writer, script editor and award-winning comedian whose book This Is Going to Hurt has been praised to the skies by everyone from Stephen Fry to the last two Jonathans you'd expect to find on the same page. That's Ross and Dimbleby. Here's Adam Kay.
Adam Kay. Good, well, I've got an appointment with him later. Now, let's start with P.P. Arnold, whose epic 50-year music career has covered a lot of territory. In this country, she was a sensation in the 1960s with hits like this. Ah, it's all brilliant stuff, P.P. Or can I call you P?
You
work with, loads of people. Mick Jagger, Small Faces, Barry Gibb, Rod Stewart, Tina Turner. Well, OK, start with Tina Turner then, because you joined Ike and Tina Turner. And if it's not too painful to say, it was rather ironic that you left an abusive marriage, really, in order to go into the music business, but work with Ike and Tina Turner. And as we know, he was no angel either, was he?
No, he wasn't. And it was on the suggestion of Tina that I told my husband a lie and followed them to Fresno to see their show and possibly become an Ikeette, that I got out of my marriage.
Yeah. So when you arrived in England, you were, I mean, you had a cherubic face. But you'd already lived quite a life because you'd had two children by then. But you immediately got on with all the various singing stars of the time.
Well, it was just destiny, really. You know, I was just this really shy, introverted, you know, single mother, you know, supporting my kids. And I came here and I did. We came to tour with the Rolling Stones.
And Mick Jagger persuaded you to go solo.
Well, Mick made me a proposition.
Well, what was that? Well, tell us about the one to do with music, anyway.
He made me a proposition. He said, he told me that his manager, who was Andrew Lou Goldham, at the time had one of the first independent record labels, Immediate Records.
Yeah.
And they were interested in me signing to Andrew's label. And if I was interested, I could stay in the UK and Mick would produce half my album and Andrew would produce the other half. And... Yeah. and I accepted.
Yeah. And it worked. You worked with him, but also with the Small Faces. You did.
The Small Faces were like my label mates.
Yeah. So what was Steve Marriott like to work with?
Fabulous, fabulous. He's my soul brother. I mean, Steve and I together were quite.
You got on well.
We got on well. We got on really well, and we did a lot of great music together. And you know, with the Small Faces, I worked with him with Humble Pie, and you know, later years when he was doing his own solo thing. And if he was still here, I'm sure we'd still be making music together.
And you recorded with Rod Stewart as well.
I did. Yeah. didn't come back home, though.
And so
I didn't want him to.
but I suppose he had a vengeance on you because he also recorded First Cut in the
Deepest. Yeah, he got me back. He recorded First Cut in the 70s, and he actually got paid. So, he got me back.
It's a Cat Stevens song originally, isn't it?
But really?
Your version is obviously the best of all of them.
Yeah. The definitive version.
Now, come to this album you've got out now, because I was going to call it a new album, but it's not strictly speaking new. You were then going to record, or you did record, with Barry Gibb. He was producing music for you. So tell us the story of that.
The Immediate Records folded, and I was left without a musical home. And I was introduced to Barry, who wanted to meet me. I had recorded a version of their hit To Love Somebody.
Yeah.
And Barry liked my version, and we met, and we hit it off. He was at the time, the brothers had kind of split up, and they weren't really making music, and Barry...
No, I'm aware of that, the Bee Gees split at the time, but it's not something you want to mention to them, I discovered, to my cost. But anyway, in that brief period,
He wanted to keep recording.
Yeah.
And so we met, and we just, you know, songs run through him like a river. And
well, you were kind of replacement for Robin Gibb then at the time.
I guess you could say that.
Yeah.
But, you know, the brothers got back together, basically, I got put on the shelf.
I first saw you on stage in Catch My Soul, which was that version, Jack Good's. Rock Othello. That was at the Roundhouse when I saw it. And you've done quite a lot of stage work since then, haven't you?
Yeah, I've done a bit. Catch My Soul was the first musical I did, and then I'm the original Belle in Starlight Express.
Yes.
The girl's answer to Five Guys Named Mo, Sweet Lorraine.
All right.
I did that with Clark Peters.
So you've spent quite a lot of time in England, in Britain, living since you first arrived.
The majority of my adult life has been in the UK.
And did you find it more welcoming to you as a singer than back home in America?
Well, you know, my solo career started here. So I started with the I was a backing singer, and I didn't really know the industry or anything at all. It was just a job to me. So really, I know more about the music industry in the UK. I'm more of a British artist because I'm an American soul singer, but I've been produced by British producers and worked with British musician, so it's a different sound. It's unique.
And on a sort of more personal level, how did you find as a black female singer coming to Britain? Was that a good atmosphere for you here, or
it was a great atmosphere. I was in demand. It's a 50-year anniversary for me, and I've been like quite independent, able to be independent during that period, during the ups and the downs and everything, and that probably wouldn't have happened in America for me.
Yeah, are things better in America now, race-wise?
Race-wise, you know, as you know, there's still lots of difficulties.
Yeah.
Some things have changed, but there's still a lot that needs to change.
All right, well, it's lovely having you here, and I've mentioned this album, and we'll play a bit of it just to give us a flavour. I know you've got an autobiography you're writing, but you haven't finished it. At least I haven't seen it yet.
Well, I finished it.
You finished it.
The publishers are just finishing editing it.
Well, don't edit it too much. We want all the dirt in
there. So you must come on.
But the Turning Tide, you've got various, as we've mentioned, there's Eric Clapton Productions, there's Barry Gibb Productions, and this one, but there's Medicated Goo, written by Steve Winwood. Traffic, so we can hear a little bit of that.
Okay. Come on.
So that's P.P. Arnold there. Her latest album, which we hear a little bit from there, is called Turning Tide, and that's out on the 6th of October on Kundalini Music. P.P.'s touring until the end of October. She's playing at Soul Weekend at Skegness on the Saturday, 23rd of September, and London's 229 Club on Wednesday, the 11th of October. You can check her website for further details. Delight to meet you. So we have... we should be congratulating Sampha, winner of this year's Mercury Prize, who performed brilliantly on Loose Ends back in January. Finally, enough on the same show as Loyal Khanna, who's also a contender for the prize. So doing music on this show is almost guaranteed to get you the Mercury Prize, as we will perhaps now be proving. Time for music now from Amadou and Mariam from Bamako in Mali, who met back in the 1970s when they were both students at the Mali Institute for the Young Blind. In the years since then, they've built a huge reputation all over West Africa and all around the world for their Afro-blues music, which mixes traditional Mali sounds with rock guitar, Syrian violins, Cuban trumpet and all sorts of other international instruments. They've won many awards and collaborated or supported work with U2, David Gilmour, Coldplay, to name but a few. So, qu'est-ce que vous allez faire pour nous aujourd'hui?
Nous allons faire un morceau qui s'appelle Fila Oubissame.
Très bien. Amadou et Mariam. That was Amadou Bagayoki on vocals and guitar, Mariam Doumbia on vocals, Charles Frederick Avot on keyboards, and Yol Yezuelo on percussion. So that was Filou Besami, and that comes from the album La Confusion, which is out on the 22nd of September. Amadou and Mariam are playing at London's Troxy on Saturday, the 4th of November. Let's come to Michael Frayn, whose distinguished literary career includes writing The Fast Noises Off, regarded as one of the funniest plays in the theatre of the last few decades. More serious dramas such as Copenhagen, a few best-selling novels, as well as humorous and satirical columns, essays, short stories and other pieces of journalism. Most of these facets of his output are represented in his latest work, a small but elegantly produced hardback book called The Pocket Playhouse. Perhaps you better... actually, I'm a bit nervous approaching, because you satirise lots of things, including being interviewed. I suppose it's a print interview, but the point still arises. A bit of ennui about having to answer the same questions, possibly by the same interviewer, but I've not interviewed you before, so...
No, you're absolutely fresh on the job, I think, but some interviewers I have done interviews with many, many times.
Yes.
And it always amazes me they can think of any fresh questions.
Well, without... I mean, slight spoiler alert, in that one, eventually the interviewee dies, so it's... But describe this. It's called A Pocket Playhouse, and that's the first piece in it is all about constructing your own theatre. There's a little bit of a dig at the way the world of the theatre works. But then you cover lots of different things.
Well, it's a follow-up to an earlier collection called Matchbox Theatre.
Mm.
And that went down all right. So I keep on writing these little sketches. So we thought we'd do another collection.
Yes.
Why am I writing these short plays? Why am I not writing long, serious plays about the Hundred Years' War or whatever?
Yes.
Because I don't have any ideas for long plays. Mm. And anyway, if Donald Trump can rule America so wisely and skillfully by writing tweets, it must be possible to write very short plays.
Yes. That's your next... that's your next challenge, is it, to become president or prime minister or something?
Next challenge is to get plays down to the length of a tweet, which I gather is 140 characters including
spaces. That's not cast members. That's the actual letters on the page. Yes.
But then I'm told by my grandchildren that young people have moved on again from tweets to social media, and again from social media to something called Snapchat.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the point of Snapchat is that it extinguishes what you've written after 5 minutes. Yeah. So my next collection is going to be in Snapchat, and if you buy it, it'll disappear.
It'll disappear.
And if you want something put on the shelf, you better buy this one.
Yeah, and if your target audience is elderly, then they won't remember they've read it and they'll keep buying it again and again. Yeah. Now, I mentioned Noises Off because that's, you know, it's regularly performed and people will be familiar with it. And, of course, it has that structure of you're seeing there's a farce on stage when you see the backstage and so forth. How did that come to you as a thing to create?
Because my very first show in the theatre was an evening called The Two of Us, five short plays, and the fifth one was a farce. Mm. And as the title suggests, the gimmick of the show was it was done by two performers, Lynn Redgrave and Richard Briers. In the farce, they had to play five characters between them. Mm. And I watched it backstage one night and saw them running insanely from door to door, doing quick changes as they went. And I thought, this is funnier than what's going on around the front.
Yes.
So I'd like to write a fast scene from behind.
Yeah.
It was a simple thought to have, but it turned out to be fiendishly difficult to do.
Well, it's very skillfully plotted, isn't it, to create three acts when you're seeing things from or different angles, different time frames.
Well, skillfully, I don't know, but it's...
it's a compliment, but
I don't recommend it.
The work has to go in there to get that right. As with the farce itself, you have to make sure the person coming out the door hasn't got his trousers on at the right point. But here you had that times three.
Absolutely, and every time you change a line in one of the bits, you have to change it in the other two acts because it's the same thing done over again.
Yeah. Now, you've also, as I've mentioned, written more serious works, Copenhagen, which is a serious play, but also works about philosophy. Is there always a serious side to you trying to bubble up through your jokes, or is there always a jokey side that's bubbling up through your seriousness?
Well, it's very difficult, even if you're writing serious stuff, it's very difficult not to see the funny side of some things. And even when I've written the philosophical books, there's quite a lot of ridiculous. A lot of life is ridiculous. A lot of life is very serious and painful and so forth. It's quite true. But mixed in with that, a lot of ridiculous things. And it's very difficult not to notice them.
I mean, years and years ago in the 60s, you wrote Towards the End of the Morning, which was a novel about, it's about working in Fleet Street as it then was. So do you look back on that era of Fleet Street as a, you know, as gone, and it's gone in your life, but in that sense, but it's gone for everybody because the papers aren't what they used to be.
I do look back on it rather wistfully because not only was the newspaper industry in Fleet Street then, and there's absolutely nothing left in Fleet Street.
Yeah.
It's just a boring road leading between the west end and the city. But then it was rather nice that you didn't have to work too hard. Nowadays, everyone works fiendishly hard. Yeah. The small staffs, very large papers. Mm. And everyone works their socks off. And as I understand it, people didn't go out to drink anymore.
No.
People used to go out and have far too much to drink in the middle of the day and then go back and work. I don't know how they did that.
I suppose towards the end of the morning in those days, when you got your work done, and having done it, you could go off for a drink at lunchtime because there's nothing more to write until the next day, whereas now you've got to update your stuff.
I wouldn't say it was that way around. Usually people went off to drink first and then came back.
Well, thank you for joining us. I note your wife, Claire Tomlin, is... She's a biographer, but she's written her own memoirs. I mean, I haven't seen it yet, but...
Coincidence, they came out on exactly the same day. We didn't plan them.
Yes, so. Presumably you feature in her memoirs. Do you emerge well from it? Or does she...
She's been very discreet. I just come in very briefly at the end.
Yes. So deus ex machina at the end.
Absolutely.
OK, anyway, well, we won't talk about her book, though, because Pocket Playhouse is published by Faber & Faber by Michael Frayn, and it's available now, as I understand it. And I'm going to turn to Phil now for the next bit of the programme.
Clive, thank you so much. Adam Kay was a junior doctor for 6 years, specialising in obstetrics and gynaecology. While he was at medical school, he somehow managed to find time to sing in a band. Now he writes and scripts edits for TV shows, including Mitchell and Webb and Mrs. Brown's Boys, as well as performing his own stand-up. His new book covering his time within the NHS is called This Is Going to Hurt. Adam Kay, welcome to Loose Ends. Talk about junior doctors very much in the news at the moment. We know about the sort of the blood and the death. We've all watched Casualty and ER. Tell us, non-doctors, about the stuff that we most misunderstand about what you do.
That's a very good question. You never really see the toll it takes on a doctor as a human being, the times you have to stay 4 hours late at work, or the people who have to reschedule their own stag do's or turn up in, you know, morning clinic on the day of their own weddings, just because it's an all-consuming job. I think when the doctors were coming under fire a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, that was one of the things that was really frustrating me. There was this sort of suggestion that that doctors were striking because it was something to do with greed, or doctors were striking because it was about working conditions, because they only really care about the best interest of the patient. And if you're the sort of person who's going to get straight A's at A-level and you know, can get into medical school, if the dollar signs are behind your eyes, you could probably choose any number of jobs. So I think what people don't realise, and what I tried to get across in my diaries, is the day-to-day toll it takes on your life.
The long hours and the sheer grind of it is the thing that comes through most about this book. This is 6 years of you keeping a diary of your time as a junior doctor. And even the phrase is a bit misleading, the notion of a junior doctor, because you're there making life and death decisions.
It is a strange phrase. So junior doctor refers to anyone who isn't a consultant, which is, I guess, the equivalent of everyone in Westminster other than the Prime Minister being called a junior politician. So there are junior doctors, in inverted commas, who are in their 40s, who've got PhDs and other, you know, huge numbers of postgraduate qualifications, who are experts in their fields, but just because they haven't yet got the consultant job title, they're called junior doctors.
So you did this job, this life and death job, and you were working the day of the London bombings, an incident very much on our minds, given what's happened at Parsons Green. You didn't see any admissions that day, but you did have to get prepared. Which hospital was it that you were at?
I was at Chelsea and Westminster Hospital.
So this was 7th of July, 2005. Yeah. You didn't see any patients that day, but you were braced for it. Tell us what happened that day.
So I was a house officer, which is the lowest rank of junior doctor, and we were all summoned to A&E because word had got out that there'd been a number of explosions across London, and we were all given tasks to do in various parts of the hospital. Mine was to go around the medical wards and discharge home any patient whose life or limb wouldn't be at risk by sending them home, so as to clear the decks for new arrivals from the bombings, which I did. And
were you scared?
That was very scary. Yeah, it was the unknown, but that was an extremely stressful. That was a very unusual day at work as a doctor.
Can you remember the first life you saved?
I can. There's the expectation. I think I even had this myself as a doctor when I just qualified, that you go round routinely saving lives. But most lives are saved in hospitals hundreds of times a day by teamwork and people working together and pulling together and making small decisions and then modifying those decisions and overall changing someone's outcome. But I do remember the first life I saved, which was I was fast bleeped to the ward, and it was a patient whose lungs were essentially full of fluid, and I jumped into this sort of emergency response mode. I wasn't quite sure I had, and I was sort of putting in drips and catheters and giving diuretics, and the guy perked up. And when the fast bleep came, I was in the middle of getting a Snickers from the vending machine, and I think if I'd have gone through with my Snickers, he might not have made it, but I decided to run to the ward. And it was a very strange feeling to sort of pull him back, you know, the bungee rope pulled him back.
He would have died.
I think, he would have died. And that was the very first time I'd saved life, and I felt like a superhero. And then I remember my registrar, who's a couple of rungs above me, sort of came along a bit later when the patient was stable, and I explained all the great work I'd done. And he said, well, probably given him a couple of weeks more on Earth, which is probably true.
So why did you give it up?
I had a bad day at work, and we all have bad days at work, so obviously. Now that I'm a writer, it just means that, you know, no one watches some sitcom or it gets terrible reviews. But when you're a doctor and the stakes are so high, a bad day at work is a very terrible thing. And working in obs and gynae on labour wards, the highs are very high. You end up with twice the patients you start with, but that means that it's a great batting average for any type of medicine. But the lows, as a result, are very, very low, and the worst possible happen that could happen on a labour ward. And I didn't really deal with it very well. I hadn't developed the emotional exoskeleton, I guess you need to cope with terrible stuff happening at work. And I became a different doctor. I had the same skin, but I was a different doctor underneath. I practiced very cautious medicine.
So just to be clear, yeah. you lost a patient, mm-hmm. and that changed you.
People people had died before, obviously, on my watch as a doctor, but this was the first time it was absolutely unexpected. Nothing I could have done differently could have changed the outcome, which made it worse, the absolute feeling of impotence. And I was told afterwards that if you're an obstetrics, you have some sort of major disaster every 5 or 6 years. But I couldn't face that ever happening to me again. And so as a result of that, which I go into some detail about it in the book, I gave up medicine.
And you say your parents never forgave you. Was that true?
It is true. They invested a lot of sort of, you know, time, money, emotion, whatever, in getting me through school and medical school. And in fairness, I never told them, I'd never told anyone the details of why I left the profession. So to their mind, I was just, I just sort of
being willful.
Phoned up one, yeah, exactly, turned up one day and said, oh, by the way, I've stopped being a doctor. I've, you know, essentially joined the circus. And and which was a very difficult thing to hear. And, it was selfish of me, I guess. But I literally couldn't talk about it, think about it. It was so profoundly upsetting. And that's because when you decide to be a doctor, that's when you choose, you make the decision when you're 16, when you're choosing your A-levels or your highers or whatever, to choose the subjects that will get you into medical school. That's a very bad age to be deciding what you want to do when you're retiring in your 60s.
And as part of the circus that you joined, you ended up performing at Prince Harry's 30th birthday party, is that...
Yeah, and there's there were a few intervening steps, but so I went from medicine. I found a plan B. I'd performed some comedy at medical school, as there's this sort of old tradition of medical school reviews, and so I ended up performing comedy, which then led to doing script writing in comedy. But in the meantime, old HRH had seen me at a gig and wanted me to play his 30th, which was definitely a weird gig. In fact, I performed a song, which is a song that I'd written ages ago and did sort of fairly well, spun around the internet, about the London Underground, a sort of sweary tirade about the tube. And I was...
I remember that and have actually downloaded that, yeah.
Thank you very much. And and I was about a couple of bars into the song, and I realised, playing in the throne room of St James's Palace, that none of these 12 people in front of me were probably aware that there was this sort of subterranean network of trains underneath the capital.
Yeah. Good talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us, Adam Kay. Adam's book, This Is Going to Hurt, is published by Picador. It's available now. He's on tour across the country, and you'll find his dates on thisisgoingtohurt.co.uk.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Time for more music now. We turn to America and Americana from Micah P. Hinson, singer, songwriter, guitarist from Abilene, Texas, whose new album, Presents the Holy Strangers, has just been released here. So you call it a modern folk opera. In broad terms, what's it about?
Let's just say it's a family from birth to death of a family during wartime. Doesn't have to be any particular war. But I think it's a basically morality tale about the importance or the degradation of what you put your faith into.
Okay, and now we have a section on this show sometimes called Wikipedia Right or Wrong. I just want to check something in your Wikipedia entry. It says that on December the 8th, 2007, you proposed to Ashley Bryn Gregory at the end of a concert at the Union Chapel in Islington here in London. Is that right?
Yeah, I did. I wanted to ask her to marry me. We'd been together for a long time, and I thought, as a person or as a musician, what is the one thing that I can do that most other people can't? And so I thought, well, there's the Union Chapel. A lot of people are on that stage, but I'm not on that stage a lot. And so it seemed to be the perfect time. Funny thing is that I won't get into it, but we had all these strange things happen before the show with some people I used to know. And she actually told me, You better not propose to me tonight, because I will say no. And so I just went ahead and just did it.
Yeah.
And we're married almost 10 years. We have a 2-year-old son named Wiley Tech Shikmali Mamali. That's Chickasaw.
Yeah.
And he's 2. And then we just had a daughter that's a month and a half, and her name is Mosey May Boone Talua.
All right, so well, that nice, happy news. What song are you going to do now?
Yeah, I'm going to sing a song called Lover's Lane. It seems like a lot of people think it's a Johnny Cash song, and I guess they're close. It's a traditional song from the Carter family, and since it was derived from A.P. Carter, we really have no idea what mountain or valley or any place in America that he was traveling. So this is just written by America.
Okay. Micah P. Hinson.
I first met you down in Lover's Lane. You were just like an angel, my little brown-eyed dame. We'd walk along and we'd sing a song, and the birds were singing too. It'd be just like heaven on earth just to be again with you. You're just the girl of my dream, but it seems that my dreams never come true.
Thank you very much. Excellent. That's rather sweet. Micah P. Hinson presents The Holy Strangers. It's available now on Full Time Hobby. Micah's playing at Broadcast Glasgow on Tuesday the 19th, Sneaky Pete's Edinburgh on Wednesday the 20th, and The Clooney 2 Newcastle on Thursday the 21st of September. There are further dates. You can look at his website for that. Thank you very much for coming back to us, Micah. Now can I welcome back to Loose Ends Camille O'Sullivan, the unique Franco-Irish singer and performer who's last on Loose Ends during last year's Edinburgh Festival, where she was staging, as she does every fringe and evening, of a selection of music and songs, old and new, to express her emotional interpretation of the song. Now you're in, you can be seen in a unique production of Wojciech in Winter. So it's a combination of George Buchner's play Wojciech and Winter Riser by Franz Schubert, and the poems of Wilhelm Müller. But this is the first time these two have been put together.
Yeah, and it's a new world for me to enter into. It was the director, Conall Morrison. It kind of sat with him for about 10 years. When we were rehearsing, he was basically saying all the lines while we were speaking. So this has sat with him a very long time. But I think it was a genius stroke to put these two works together, Wojciech and Winterreise. And I'd known Schubert, but I'd never sung it before. And it just lifts it to another place, as music does.
Yes.
And, we're in the Barbican. We are in one of the most beautiful stage sets I've ever performed in. I'd practically pay myself as a performer just to stand in that thing. Jamie Vartan put 102 upright and baby grand pianos on stage.
Yeah.
And I remember getting the script when I was offered it last year. It said, it will be a landscape of pianos. And I love the notion that sentence became a reality. And also there's a lot of snow, so we're like in this little snow globe.
It's very much stressing the winter. I suppose, are relatively easy to get, pianos, but to put them in place and to carry them around.
Yeah, it is a mixture of like old harmoniums and stuff. And it's supposed to be kind of, the inner mind of what's going on with, I suppose, this wonderful old, I suppose, one of the first modern plays, but, oppression set upon this man. I happen to be his partner. And also, it kind of shows that people are good people at the heart of it, but they do stupid things sometimes.
Yes.
And they do things that they regret terribly. I find it fascinating, like any play like Shakespeare, it's going to end badly, but it's the journey you take. It's transformative for the audience and for the, actors on stage.
The poor old Wojciech's in love with you.
Yes.
That's Patrick O'Kane. And
Patrick.
and possibly you're in love with him, but nonetheless you find attraction elsewhere.
Yeah, I suppose it's, there's an oppression going on and I want another type of life. I have a child, but other things kind of excite me. But I pay a high price in the end. I'm very emotional. I'm Irish and French, but Paddy O'Kane, who is playing the lead, is a wonderful actor. And I'm backstage kind of looking through the cracks of the piano and I'm quite upset by what I've done to him. And there is much beauty in the Schubert music that it helps you kind of feel empathy for the characters and you can be more sad and more vulnerable and more angry. That's where music allows you to get up to, not mischief, but bring things to life and multiply it by 100.
The music is very dramatic, obviously. I mean, you can almost feel the same sort of thing like Kurt Weill. You can see where he might have... the tradition he was perhaps deriving some of his writing from.
Sing a songspiel. I mean, that's what I'm into. I'm not a trained singer. I was an architect who did the same thing to my parents, joined the circus and gave them a heart attack.
You were nudged into it by a bad car accident.
Yeah.
You suddenly realised, well, I might as well do something I really want to do.
Yeah, because I was probably too nervous and I didn't think, you know, I should be up there on the stage. But the car crash, definitely learning how to walk again and, you know, definitely made me go, look, you only have this one chance.
It's a different discipline to be in a play, a musical show, as opposed to with your regular shows. You pick the songs.
The
I dare say you change them night by night if you change of mood. But here you have to do, you've got to do what's in the text.
I feel like a communist on stage. I like the whole thing of sharing a show with people. You know, Stephen Brennan and Barry McGovern, who is well known for his Beckett interpretations, Rosie Linehan, Patty, of course. And so every person has quite a quirky personality. And we're laughing with the people doing our hair backstage because they said the Irish have landed. Like the whole corridor, it's just mischief. But, you know.
Well,
but
you have a lot of hair on stage. Patrick doesn't get so much.
No, he doesn't.
Well, you're doing just this week at the Barbican, but then you're off to the Gaiety Theatre in
well, Dublin. Funnily enough, 2 days later in the Barbican, I'm transforming into rock and roll, Jim Jarmusch, as a guest with Malatu and Alex Kapranos from Franz Ferdinand and Julie Holland. We do his wonderful, evocative, surreal movies have this. The heartbeat of them is a lot of his choice of music. And then we go to the Gaiety in Dublin for the Dublin Theatre Festival for Wojciech.
Right.
And then I go off on my own journey doing the Olympia in November for my own show.
That's Olympia in Dublin?
Yeah. November 17th, and then Brel in New York.
So,
and
come to Brel in your own show, this is your selection of songs?
Yeah, it's the Carney Dream.
The Carney Dream, which you did last year.
Which is kind of Circus and Dreams and Radiohead and Nick Cave and Leonard Cohen and Bowie. And so it's where you're quite chameleon on stage. And
you make yourself perform circus performing, even though you're scared of it.
The swing is always good fun when you meet a technician going, how high can we go? And they're like, are you crazy? So that's great.
You don't need to do that.
You don't need to do it, I know, but you have to do it.
And then Jacques Brel, you're doing on...
I just did a live CD from Wilton's Music Hall, that beautiful venue in London, which we'll return to in April next year. But the Brel we're bringing to New York. And so we just released that live CD, which I haven't a clue. Like, it's never mind the Snapchat. I don't know how to do an iTunes yet. It's all very home cooked. Yeah.
So what are you
doing? CDs are at home under the bed, and you can contact me on my website.
What are you doing in your spare? What are you doing in your spare time, Camille?
I am absolutely thinking of how to have a break and rest. It's all cool, but definitely time to get back to Dublin and just relax and do some Lego with my daughter or whatever.
Right.
But it's all brilliant. I love this world where you can switch and.
Other toys are available, but Wojciech in Winter is at London's Barbican tonight, then at the Gaiety Theatre as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival between the 3rd and the 8th of October, and Camille, as you mentioned, is performing at the Olympia Theatre in Dublin on Friday the 17th of November, and her album Camille Sings Jacques Brel is available now. Thank you for joining us, and we thank for all of you joining us. You can hear us again, as well as recent Loose End guests such as Maureen Lipman, Isla Fisher and Alan Johnson. This is available via the BBC Radio 4 website and all good podcast suppliers. But in any format, in any event, my thanks to all my guests, Camille O'Sullivan, Michael Frayn and P.P. Arnold, Amadou and Mariam and Micah P. Hinson, Phil Gale and Adam Kay. Next week, my co-host is Christopher Eccleston, and our guests will include John O'Farrell and Squeeze. But until then, for me, for now, goodbye. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and to hear full live performances by any of our musicians from the last 30 days, head to the Loose Ends website.